Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to again introduce Professor Elizabeth Cobbs from Texas A&M. She's a historian. She wrote great. Last time she was here was on foreign policy, whether we're a policeman, whether we should continue to be a policeman in the world, or whether we should step back from that role, which was turned into a PBS show. Now she's here, wrote a book on the Hamilton affair, and how many are going to see the musical in Hamilton that's coming very soon? Very good. Perfect. Professor Cobbs.
Well, thank you so much. And first of all, let me say that I do not have tickets to the musical. So if any of you has one of your partners drop out, I can give you my phone number afterwards. I wrote this book about Alexander Hamilton. I started on it a number of years ago. And it was a crazy thing because my publisher and my agent said, who's going to want to read about Alexander Hamilton? And I'm like, but it's such a great story. You know, how could you not want to read about Alexander Hamilton? So I persevered, and then I had the incredible luck of following in the footsteps, picking up after Lin-Manuel Miranda. So what a great honor that's been. But I mean, here's the story of a man who, when he was 11 years old, his father had abandoned his mother. He was being raised by a single mother, and his mother dies. He's orphaned. He's abandoned. That's when he's 11. When he's 21, he's chief aide to George Washington. This is a young man who, when the Declaration of Independence was written in 1776, he was an immigrant scholarship student at King's College. When the Constitution was written, he was the principal organizer of that effort. So how do you even get that? I mean, somebody who rises that fast and does it, you know, not because he's got any special sponsor. In fact, does it despite the fact that he has this shame, this stain on him, which is that his parents weren't legally married, which is another story. It's an interesting one, but we won't go there. But so how do you explain this kind of person? So in any case, so I wrote a novel. I am a professional historian. Most of my books are nonfiction, but I think there's some things we can't understand unless we approach them through fiction. And it gives us a way of looking at the world through the eyes of people who lived a long time ago and going, wow, what was that like? What did that feel like? And so there's a really separate and good and important, interesting role for fiction as well as nonfiction. So the book I wrote is about something that often, especially any books with romance in them, are not typically about in America today. Because normally, the stuff of modern novels, when you look at romance, it's about, you know, people getting together or breaking up. Right? It's never about that much harder, more complicated, more tortuous, more joyous, more heroic miracle of two people staying in love no matter what life throws at them, including even murder. So that's one way in which the novel is fairly different from most novels about love. But it's also different because it's a novel about politics, and most of our novels about politics are about the, you know, the double dealing, the backstabbing, the kind of cheesy, corrupt individuals that we love to hate, meaning politicians. We have trouble taking seriously love of country. It's something that looks kind of false to us today. Somebody's putting that on. It's unreal. And we're cynical about it. So how do you write about people for whom this was deeply uncynical, you know, whose idealism was completely real? And how do you talk about that? Well, now, first of all, I have to admit to you that actually, when I first went to write the novel, I was doing the cheesier alternative, which is to say, I thought, well, you know, politicians, this will be good, because I must admit, personal sharing here, I tend to look on the bright side of life. And so I thought, I've got to get down there and write about a really good bad guy. Now, my husband's a filmmaker, Jim Shelley, and he told me before, he said, you know, a bad villain makes for a good movie. So I actually, when I was thinking about this and I was thinking about Hamilton, I envisioned him in the way that I had been taught about him. I got my PhD in American history at Stanford University. And so over the years when I've as a professor, taught about Alexander Hamilton and that whole founding period, you know, I sort of thought of him as this elitist, this Machiavellian, you know, this kind of brilliant, useful, but kind of cold, rational actor who really was an elitist, a monarchist, and who was the foil to patriotic good men like Thomas Jefferson. I know, you laugh now, right? Well, we could talk about Jefferson. In fact, maybe when we get to the question and answers, we'll hash it out about Thomas Jefferson. So I was thinking, you know, okay, this is good. I'm going to write the novel that I really should write. I'm going to write about an antagonist rather than the protagonist. It'll be kind of interesting to do that. So being the person I've been trained to be, then I go about my research and I read the biographies and I read the papers of Alexander Hamilton and I went to his birthplace in Nevis and I did some research on St. Croix where he grew up in the West Indies. And then I fell through the looking glass because I realized that he was a very different man from the person I had thought I was going to find. That instead of the kind of scheming, preening monarchist, I found an absolute idealistic, patriotic person, an incredibly tender lover, a man who was in his public life what we today would probably call a triple threat. Now, by the way, this may be the reason why he's so reviled, because it's so hard not, it must have been really hard not to be incredibly jealous of him. Think of this, right? You know, just, triple threat. What does that mean? So he's a war hero. He is a statesman. He's a thinker. So soldier, thinker, politician, as well as one of the most misunderstood heroes of the American Revolution. So I went from thinking that, wow, you know, it'd be kind of nice to write a book about Alexander Hamilton to feeling like I had to write a book about Alexander Hamilton, despite what my agent and publishers were all saying. And by the way, of course, what a joy to discover that Lin-Manuel Miranda apparently felt the same way, which I discovered as I was going through this. And that was just wonderful, actually, to sort of feel like there was someone else who went, yeah, wow, we've got to talk about this guy. So to get us all up on the same page, although I realize you probably are already there, but maybe someone out in the audience isn't, who was Alexander Hamilton? What were sort of the basic biography? So grew up in the West Indies. So that made him as much a member of the sort of British Empire, of course, is someone in New Hampshire or in New York, because these were all British colonies, Nova Scotia, you know, Nevis, where he was born, etc. So not all of them, of course, came into the American Revolution, but he was as bona fide a member of the British Empire as George Washington. So in his public role, he became an aide-de-camp to Washington, which meant that he was one of the most he was the person who was there all the time, basically writing down orders, sending out things, entertaining negotiations, doing translating. By the way, he was fluent in French. His mother was a French Huguenot, so he was a person who was the first point of contact, one of the first points of contact for the Marquis de Lafayette, who was learning his English. So he had that role during the Revolution. Then, at the end of the Revolution, he led the last charge, the last major charge of the Revolution, which was at Yorktown. And this was a great moment for Hamilton because basically Washington had been kind of keeping him chained to a desk. I need you here, you know. I can't have you out in the field. I don't want you to get your head blown off because I need you here. So Hamilton was in the field and was at various battles, but he wanted really a command. And so at the very last, he got a command at Yorktown. Then he goes on, of course, to be an organizer of the Constitutional Convention, because he could see, and this is interesting, he saw that this whole Articles of Confederation thing was completely funky. Now, how did he know that? He knew that partly because one of the things that all of the military men in the Revolution understood is that Congress was unable to provide for the needs of the men in the field. So the fact that they didn't have shoes, that they were walking in the snow, they didn't have enough to eat, that wasn't about the British. That was about the Americans. That was about the fact that the states, there was no way to compel a state to pay its portion of things. And the states didn't. They said, we are separate governments, etc. So anyway, he was a big organizer of the Constitution and, of course, the principal author of the Federalist Papers. Now, the Federalist Papers, again, you're like, okay, I think I remember what those are about, but let me remind you, which was the Constitution was incredibly controversial. There were many, many people who said, we do not need a federal government. By the way, there are still those people today. So Hamilton said, no, we've got to have this, you know, for all kinds of reasons. And so the Federalist Papers were essentially a propaganda campaign to explain what had happened in Philadelphia, why they had written this new document, why we needed a new actual government. And he wrote the majority of the Federalist Papers, which was a series of essays, and James Madison wrote about a third of them, and there were four that were written by a third person named John Jay, and a judge and an attorney. So he was organizer of Federalist Papers. Then he became Treasury Secretary of the United States under George Washington, which is, of course, the hot seat, especially in think of the revolutionary countries we've all heard about, right, over the years. And you know that one of the big problems, you get a new government, but my gosh, what you're like thrown to the wolves. You know, how do you get up, pick yourself up, create an economy, get things moving, make it possible for the country to thrive, for people to eat? So the Secretary of the Treasury was a tough job, and he served very well in that, created the first bank of the United States, created the Coast Guard, created, helped to develop a manufacturing system, everything. So as Ron Chernow, the great biographer of Hamilton, says, essentially Hamilton is in many ways the creator of the national government. So as you're sitting here in your comfortable seats and, you know, traffic lights change on time, you know, kind of keep in mind that people like Alexander Hamilton were a very, very big part of that. All right, so that's part of the story. There is another half of the story. And one of the great pleasures of writing this book was to learn about Eliza Schuyler Hamilton, who was Hamilton's wife. And she's a person who, I didn't know her name. And what I found as I researched her story and came to, in a way, know her, I came to feel that she's one of the most unrecognized and one of the most important of the founding mothers. Now, some writers, especially Cokie Roberts, I don't know if you've read her stuff, fabulous writer, wonderful journalist, and she's written a series of books, Founding Ladies of Liberty, Founding Mothers, etc. And she's done some really good work putting Elizabeth Schuyler in that kind of pantheon, you might say. But one of the nice things about a book like this is that you really get to look at one character and develop them. Now, here's the interesting thing. So Alexander Hamilton, to write his story, is like somebody gives you for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever, they give you a present of a 1,000-word jigsaw puzzle, and you open up and there are 1,500 pieces in there. Now, 500 don't fit. So you have to like, oh no, that's what Jefferson said. That doesn't fit. That's what his enemies said. That one's not in there. That's Hamilton. Elizabeth Schuyler is like getting your 1,000-piece word puzzle, and there are 288 pieces inside. And you're like, oh my gosh, you know, okay, I have the structure of the story, but you know, is she holding a cat? Is she sitting on a tuffet? Is she sitting on the bank of a river? Who is she? And so how we find out about a person like that is in all different kinds of ways. And part of it is through the letters that people wrote to her, things people wrote about her. And a lot of this really comes from finding out what Alexander wrote, because he was incredibly prolific. This man could not stop writing, as Lin-Manuel Miranda, you know, writes so beautifully, and I'm sure some of us could sing along to some of these lyrics, but the room where it happened, et cetera. And so she's a person, though. She famously destroys her letters to him. All right, now why does she do that? By the way, I have a different theory from Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, he comes out of chronology. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the interesting thing is that she did not destroy his letters to her. Now, why not? Now, if she really did not want their private lives to be known, she could have just, you know, she would have done what Martha Washington did. Martha Washington, as was kind of customary at that time, she destroyed her letters to George and George's letters to her, because the idea in that era was sort of like, well, that's our personal life. That's not, you know, for politics, so different from today, right? Like, we want to know, we feel we deserve to know everything. But in that time, that was something you sort of set aside. So it was often the case that women ducked out of history, and they ducked out of history because they thought that's not history. History proper is what people do out in the public sphere. And so why didn't Eliza destroy her husband's letters? And I'm, you know, in a way, you don't know. None of us can know, no. But maybe it's partly because she felt he was taken from her so early, so wrongly. How could she destroy anything that he had left, anything that he had given her? Which tells us a lot about her love for him you know, that she loved him as she did. And of course, part of the mystery of their relationship is why he has an affair, and we'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, in terms of getting to know Eliza, what I did is I went back to Hamilton's letters and I looked carefully at his letters to her. And one of the curious things about their relationship, and again, this goes back to the nature of love, is that he was a person who seemed to fall more deeply in love with his wife over the course of their marriage. And he loved her very much at the beginning. And in fact, one of his famous letters before, when they were first engaged and before they were actually the marriage actually happened, he would write her and he said, "I meet you in every dream, and when I wake, I cannot close my eyes again for ruminating on your sweetness." So he was very tender towards her. But to give you another letter, which again I kind of pulled out of random from his papers, and this was 3 years into the marriage, or a year and a half into their marriage, 2 years. And they had by that time a baby boy. But he was doing his thing, and he was traveling around, and she was up at her parents' house in Albany. So he wrote her, and he said, "The post, my angel, has met with some interruption, I suppose by the river being impassable, which deprives me of the pleasure of hearing from you. I am inexpressibly anxious to learn you have begun your journey. I write this for fear of the worst, but I should be miserable if I thought this letter would find you at Albany. If by any misapprehension you should still be there, I entreat you, lose not a moment in coming to me. I have borne your absence with patience till about a week ago, but but the period we have fixed for our reunion being come, I can no longer reconcile myself to it. Every hour in the day, I feel a severe pang on this account, and half my nights are sleepless. Come, my charmer, and relieve me. Bring my darling boy to my bosom." Now, by the way, the last letter he wrote her was the letter he wrote her the night before he went to the famous duel with Aaron Burr and the night before his death. And in that letter, he called her, his last letter, he called her best of women, best of wives. And I don't think it was to flatter her. It was to describe her and how he felt in the end. So, you know, other people described her in a very flattering way. She was very small, she was very petite, she was very elegant, she was quite an optimist. Apparently she interrupted sometimes, was known to perhaps do that. she was just very full of life, passionate love not only of her family, but love of country. And again, this gets back to love of country. How do we talk about love of country in an uncynical way to whom, about people for whom this was an uncynical moment. So in any case, she was the person who really, you know, embodied this kind of, in a way, the less scheming aspect of that founding period. And so it was a great honor to write about her. As they said later, that her friends beheld her with affectionate wonder. And after his death, she went on, and of course, her children were orphaned. She married an orphan, and she started New York's first private orphanage. She lived another 50 years without her husband. So she was 47, and at 97, she finally passed away. And in that entire time, she never remarried. But she was quite an activist. I mean, she, in starting this orphanage, you know, and she's just this little teeny tiny thing, and she goes to the New York State Legislature, and she says, "You will pay the light bill." And, you know, and so she's negotiating things. By the way, after her husband's death, after Jefferson is out of office, she goes back to the U.S. Congress, and she says, "I want my husband's pension." Because one of the things that Alexander Hamilton was doing, and again, part of the enjoyment of writing a novel about political policy issues, is to sort of make things that seem obscure to us come to life. So, for example, one of Hamilton's accomplishments is that he felt that the Revolutionary veterans, war veterans, that they should be paid. And so there was this question of how do you get their pensions to them. And one of the things he did was to renounce his own pension. He didn't want it to be said that he was trying to get pensions so that he would get a pension. So of all of our founders, or almost all of our founders, he was a man without money. He was a man whose name was made only by himself, and that was against coming, countering the fact that he was known as illegitimate, so it was very difficult. And yet he rejected the idea of any kind of pay for his years and years that he had spent in the Revolutionary Army. So it was Eliza who went back and said to the Congress, "You will pay me my husband's pension, because she had no money by this point, by the way. And it was, she was very lucky that Hamilton's many good friends raised the money to pay for her mortgage. Otherwise, she would have lost the house that they built. So I just told you about this awesome marriage. And you're like, well, wait, isn't it called the Hamilton Affair? And of course it is. So the really big question, and this was interesting to me again as a historian, because, you know, he wrote about it publicly. This was the first sex scandal of the American government. And he didn't just admit it. He wrote pages and pages. He wanted people to be clear on the dimensions of this affair so that they wouldn't think it was some other form of corruption. So he even admitted that he had taken this woman to their bed, to his wife's bed. So why would this guy cheat on his wife a decade into their marriage? You know, they had a number of children by that point. When they were both, by the way, 34 years old. So I say this because, you know, we always think of the founders, they were all old guys, right? No, they're only old now. If they'd kept alive, they would have been old. They were young at the time. So that's one mystery. Why did he have the affair? And then why did she stay with him? In fact, go on to have two more children with him. Now, the youngest of their children was only 2 years old when he walked to his death willingly. So that's another mystery. Why does he do that? Why does he leave this woman who he's already betrayed once with seven kids to raise on her own without any money? Why does he take that kind of risk? And then also, how does she, you know, how does she pick up? And how does she regain her self-respect after the affair is made known? So these are the kinds of mysteries that to me were a lot of fun in terms of kind of looking at, you know, what this story really is all about, and sort of piecing it together. And that's one of the things I can say as a historian, and I write and have written other books as well. And the big difference in nonfiction and fiction is with nonfiction, like, you know, you can't say it unless you shouldn't. You can't say it unless you can prove it. So we don't know why he cheated. But if you write a novel, you got to have a reason why he cheated. You got to be thinking through why he cheated. And so that's one of the interesting things. And I think one of the great values of fiction in all our lives is that, especially in historical fiction, which this is, of course, is it gives us a chance to walk through history in the order that the people who lived it walked through it. And they didn't know how it was going to turn out. They didn't know if they were going to win. They didn't know if they were going to be hanged. They didn't know their wife was going to catch them. Such things. And so I think that's one of the great joys for me of writing fiction about American history. So the last thing I guess I'll just say something about, and then I'd love to hear your questions about it, because I could talk about Alexander Hamilton and have, as my family will attest many times, at great length. I think one of the really important questions is, you know, why is Hamilton so relevant today? And I think you could take almost any headline out of the newspaper and say why it's relevant to Alexander Hamilton. This is a man who's an immigrant. And as we know, has brought such gifts into our country. Our country would not be the country it is without Alexander Hamilton. And in that sense, it's very interesting. So here's an immigrant who built the government, but also here's a woman and her family who welcomed an immigrant into their lives and recognized, you know, that this is a person who should be judged on their merit, not on their family name, not anything else, on what they themselves brought. And there's a great lesson in that for all of us. And then, of course, the other question is, how are we to understand things like honor? You know, is honor important in government? What does that mean to have honor? And Alexander walked to his death because of honor. And then lastly, even such things as, you know, what does it mean? And I was just, again, I was sort of looking at today's headlines, and we're all hearing about Russian infiltration, right, or Russian hacking in the American government, right? So that's very, very contemporary. But But if we understand history, and even if we understand Alexander Hamilton's own story, we know that so many of these things are things we've dealt with before. And in fact, at the time of the French Revolution, which is Hamilton was dealing with it, one of the big scandals of the early government was that the French ambassador came over and was talking with the political opposition and meeting with them, and he was upset because the U.S. government was favorable enough to France's revolution, and there was a big scandal over what was called the Genet Affair. And in the end, in fact, this became a part of what was called the farewell address by Alexander. It was George Washington's farewell address, but it was also Hamilton who helped very much to write it. And one of the things that they talked about was the dangers of partisanship. Oh, that could have some relevance for today. And then one of the things that Washington said, and Hamilton was a part of the crafting of the farewell address, he said that partisanship, and I was quoting George Washington, but Hamilton was also a part of advising George Washington on this very, very important document. And he said that partisanship, quote, agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against the other, foments riot occasionally and insurrection. It opens the door to foreign influence and corruption, which finds a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passions. Thus, the policy and the will of one country are subjected to the policy and will of another. So I think that this should probably ring some bells for those of you who've been looking at the newspaper lately. So there's that question, these conundrums, these difficulties, the challenges we face as a country, these are challenges that our leaders have faced from the very beginning of the country. And so learning about people like Alexander Hamilton and Eliza Schuyler gives us insight into how not only they dealt with them, but how we might deal with such challenges today. So this was just a fun journey for me, and I hope you all buy my book, because someday I'm going to see that play. But you were much smarter than me, and you got tickets, I hope, when they were more reasonable, and I've been priced out for, well, a year now. So maybe someday I'll get there too. So please let me see what questions you have. Yes, ma'am.
Right.
I talk about why you had the fair? Oh, absolutely. Do you want to hear my theory? All right. Well, I love to talk about this theory. Because, of course, there are two sides. Well, there are really three sides. If you include the people, the people with whom he had the affair, of course, he had the affair only with someone's wife. But the someone, we think, was propositioning his wife probably to do this. And that's not clear. Even Alexander, in my novel, is not sure, were they trying to trap him or not? There's indication that they could well have been. And he doesn't know, because he doesn't know. He wouldn't have known. Dang it, are they trying to trap me, he thinks, after this all happened. But in terms of why Alexander was vulnerable, I mean, he's a man who never had, that we know of, any other affairs. Now, I say this partly, and you're like, well, maybe we just don't know. Yeah, but usually when you have one, frankly, people tend to do the same thing again and again. And also, the political opposition had every reason to find more dirt. You know how these things are. If somebody's messed around once, the next person comes forward. Oh, yeah, I'm raising my hand too. So there was never any indication that he had for other affairs. So something happened at that particular time. The month in which they started this affair was probably the most intense month of all of Hamilton's time in government. This is when the bank, which was a very controversial measure, this is when the first bank stocks were issued. You know, he was doing all kinds of things at the time, extraordinary pressure on him. Congress, you know, practically throwing things. I mean, it was very volatile. So he had a lot of heat on his back. But that's no excuse, as we know. And then one thing that happens is the woman with whom he had the affair came to him and asked him for money, asked him for help. Now, Hamilton, we also have to know, his mother died when he was 11. His mother had been an abused woman, very likely. His mother had been imprisoned for supposedly adultery, although it was really more that she left her husband. And in that era, if you left your husband, you know whose fault that was, right? It was yours. And so she was forbidden ever to remarry, and that's why he was illegitimate, because she could not legally marry his father. So he was very sensitive to women in danger, damsels in distress, etc. Now, the other thing, however, I think was going on, this is kind of fun for me, again, writing fiction and nonfiction are a little different, especially historical fiction. If you're writing historical fiction, you actually literally have to look kind of moment by moment, day by day, what's happened, because there's no big generalizations. It's only like what happened today. And so one of the things I noticed about Eliza Schuyler, her mother had like, I can't remember now, it was 14 or 15 children. Half of her mom's children died before they got out of infancy, half of her brothers and sisters. So I'm thinking, Eliza does not want that same thing, right? And there's no such thing as birth control, by the way. Now, there's birth control kind of if you're a prostitute. They actually had condoms, but my goodness, married people wouldn't do that sort of thing. You know, so I don't think there's any, there's no real contraception. So the only contraception is, of course, abstinence. Now, the only time in their entire marriage where she did not have a baby every other year was in the 3.5 years before this affair starts. So I'm thinking, you know, it's logical. I mean, it's partly, you know, it's human nature. He's a 34-year-old man, you know, right? So I think that that's part of what happens. There's a strain in their marriage. He's under a lot of strain. She leaves the day he meets this woman, and she's gone for 2 months. Her annual trip up to Albany, because it's very dangerous to stay with your kids in Philadelphia where there's yellow fever, et cetera, et cetera. So, gosh, I'm a professor. What was your question? So anyway, so he has an affair, it's devastating for Eliza. I mean, how do we know it's devastating for her? Partly, and just one last thing, and then we'll take other questions. But she finds out, it's this long, complicated story. Read the novel. But part of what happens is she does find out she's 8.5 months pregnant in New York in July. So it is not a good situation. And she gets, the day she finds out, the day after she finds out, she gets on a sloop, a sailing ship, and sails upriver to her parents' home in Albany. It's a 2-day sail, and she's 8.5 months pregnant on a ship with men. She has to get out. She has to get away from Alexander. She does not want to see her husband. She goes up there. She does fairly early go into labor. She has her baby there. But then she did take their oldest son with her, and he got very ill. And so she comes back to New York and comes back and faces her husband and figures out how to put her life back together.
Right. I'd like to mention to the audience that they're listening to Professor Elizabeth Cobb speaking about her novel, The Hamilton Affair. She's a historian. And for the questions, we need to use the microphone so that they get recorded along with us. So if anybody has a question, you can come and line up back here at the mic. Okay, so who has a question? And is anybody willing to come back to the mic? Yes, okay, great.
Thank you, I love questions.
So, no, it has to be done on the mic. Yeah, sorry. Otherwise, no one can hear it on the radio.
You mentioned that fully explained, which I knew, the whole affair. And yet you also said, we don't know why he had the affair. So he did not write about why he had the affair, since he explained everything else about it?
He wrote about it in the sense of, he was writing about why he wasn't corrupt in another way. So he was explaining that this affair had happened. He was being accused of having given he was blackmailed during the affair. The woman with whom we had the affair, her husband blackmailed him for about 6 months. And the political opposition said, well, basically, you gave that money to that guy so he could buy stocks for you, so that you could, in a corrupt way, get some bonds on the side for the Bank of the United States, et cetera. So he wanted to explain, being Alexander Hamilton, that he would never, ever, ever, ever rip off the U.S. government. So a lot of the story was about that. No, he didn't say, boy, she was hot. I mean, I don't think you say that kind of thing, you know. Another question?
You didn't mention anything about the duel, and I wonder if your novel does speculate on what that was about and what compelled him, and if you'd share that with us.
Yes. So anybody who doesn't want a spoiler, just put your fingers right over your ears, unless you're driving, in which case just turn off the radio, a podcast, and come back to it. Yes. The novel starts with Alexander in St. Croix and before his mother's death and goes up through Eliza's death. I know that's a lot to cover in a short amount of time, but I trust me, I do. So in terms of the duel, it's a mystery. And there have been people who have said, oh my gosh, what a half-cocked crazy guy this Alexander Hamilton is. In fact, I saw a PBS documentary that kind of burned me because it was sort of saying, well, you know, none of the other founders got killed in a duel. Therefore, you know, he must have been like had a death wish or, you know, been kind of, you know, whatever. I don't think any of that makes sense for a variety of reasons. But I think a lot of it, I mean, certainly it has to do with honor, knowing that if he doesn't accept Aaron Burr's challenge, that the only way he can get Aaron Burr off his back is to say, oh yeah, everything I said about you all those years back when you were like this total opportunist, I was wrong. I apologize. So he's not going to do that because that would mean he'd have to lie. He also doesn't want to be called a coward, which is a grave accusation at this time. And he was a military man too. We'd have to remember this was a man who lived by a code of honor. But the other thing I think, and this is one of the saddest things, is that his oldest son, the one who accompanied Eliza on that mad dash up to Albany, their son Philip, their eldest son, had been killed in a duel over his father's honor about 2 years earlier. So think of it. Your son has stood up for your honor, for the family honor, has done this brave and dangerous and ultimately fatal thing for you. And can you imagine as a father saying, well, I'm not going to do that. Boy, that would be dopey. You know, I think, and in fact, of course, the amazing part of the story is that he is killed with the same gun. I mean, it's a set of dueling pistols that, to add to the total craziness, the dueling pistols were owned by his brother-in-law who was married to Angelica. And I know you're going to have a question about that in a minute. So he was married to Angelica, and he had these dueling pistols that he had used. His name was John Church. He had used these pistols to duel Aaron Burr a number of years earlier. And Aaron Burr was known as a lousy shot. So anyway, he'd been fine, but Philip uses these and is killed. And then his father has to decide, do I accept this challenge or not? So in the end, I feel a lot of it has to do with his son.
I've almost finished reading the biography, and one of the things that came up in there I thought was interesting is that while he loved his wife, there's a strong implication that he might have actually preferred his wife's sister. Is that in your book, or what are your thoughts on that?
The old Angelica Schuyler question. Well, so now Lin-Manuel Miranda is a playwright, and he has to do in 2 hours what I get, 300 pages or something. And he's not a historian. So was this implication? There was gossip, and Ron Chernow reports the gossip. Well, you know, if he did that, he would probably do this. And Angelica and he were very close, and she was a notorious flirt. Well, by the way, so was Alexander. And this was the period in the 18th century where flirtation was really a part of social discourse. In fact, one of my favorite things about Hamilton, at one point, one of his friend's wives wrote to him in his capacity as Treasury Secretary to ask him to help with some project. Now, she needed help getting something through the government machinery. And he didn't get to the letter for a while. And then he wrote her and he said, oh, I'm so sorry. I've been very busy. I'm sorry I didn't get to, your request. I will do anything to make it up to you, but just remember I'm a married man. So this is the way kind of folks talked. I mean, it was very different. So in terms of Angelica Schuyler, I don't see that. I realize that, again, Miranda turns up the volume a little bit on that, and Ron Chernow reports, as a good historian does, what people were saying. Of course, some of his friends had said, don't say it had been to one affair because they'll accuse you of 20. I mean, this is the way political opponents work. But he felt he had to be truthful. I think that if you were actually having an affair with your wife's sister who was just a year older than your wife and you were all very close and you spent a lot of time together and you read each other's letters to one another, and you just wouldn't act that way. You'd have such a massive guilt complex that you'd be like, oh, well, hello, Mrs. Church. So nice to see you, sister-in-law. You would be acting in a different way. So he acts very intimate and very, in a very flirtatious, very fun manner with Angelica. And I just, as a person, as well as a historian, I don't think that's consistent behavior with a person who's carrying on.
I had a similar question about Angelica, but my impression was that it was an emotional affair.
Yeah, and that's
a good
point.
You didn't see that in their letters?
Yes, you do. I mean, they were very, very close. And again, these are... Most of us don't come from large families today, or at least large functional ones. So they were very, very close. But that's also part of the interesting thing, is to write about their children, write about those family dynamics and family relations. She's number two, Eliza is. And her bigger sister has always got everybody's attention. Her bigger sister is like the witch. She's the one who Thomas Jefferson writes to, you know. Think what that's like for Eliza. And she's like the good girl. But she is the one Alexander chooses and marries. But in terms of his relationship with Angelica, I think that they were very close. And in fact, when Eliza got on that ship and went upriver to Albany to see her mom and her dad, Alexander, left behind with the kids, went immediately to see Angelica and said, "Oh my God." And it's Angelica who writes her sister and says, you know, "Don't give up on him. Don't give up on him. You know, yes, if you're married to someone like this, it's going to be painful, but you're going to see the world through the eyes of an eagle. And, you know, and he's a good man."
I have one more question regarding Eliza. Everything I've heard, and you said it again tonight, is she went on to have a very prolific career and did many things. How would you summarize the activities she did after he passed away?
Well, she became a philanthropist. And actually, I think that that's a clue into how she got her self-respect back, right? Because, you know, just again, put yourselves in that position. Your husband admits to the whole world and tells them in pretty gross detail about this affair that they had. You know, how is she going to keep her head up? I mean, just in mortification. So one of the interesting things, again, if you look at the record, the minute sort of day-by-day record, about 5 months after that event, and she's like, hiding, right? A woman comes to her who is a philanthropist, Isabella Graham, and says, "You know, Mrs. Hamilton, would you be willing to add your name to the list of ladies who are supporting this organization to help women who have small children who have lost their husbands?" By the way, just think of that description, because that's going to be Eliza. You know, she doesn't know that. She's going to lose her husband and be there taking care of little kids without anybody's help. But she joins in that effort. And I think it's a way to understand, again, how she sort of comes back. And so instead of hiding in corners, she's out there telling other people, "You need to give to this cause." And she becomes a public person in a way she had not been before these events. Because this is a period of time in which even what I am doing now would have been utterly scandalous. For a woman to get up and speak to an audience, for a woman to go out and be a public person was... you know, was really considered, you know, something that you just wouldn't do. It would just, you know, it would be scandalous to do that. So that's, I think, what she does. And that's how her life, how her heart mends.
You speak about the mortification that she felt. And you also mentioned honor. Both of those things, I mean, the current president and presidents over the last 20 years have done lots of things that other people would say, once you've done that and everyone knows about it, how can you stand up in public again? And they don't seem to have any difficulty. So how did that shift? Why did mortification disappear, you know, from our society? Shame is gone. Honor, people don't, you know, do things for honor either very often. I mean, yes, people want to be honorable, but not in the same way, under the same rules, and how crucial and fatal the actions were.
Yeah, well, how do we lose our shame?
Yeah.
You have no shame. Well, right. You know, that's a good question. It's hard to answer it, really. I mean, to know how that sort of slow devolution happened. But, I mean, part of it is us, right? It's not just that we need to have, our leaders need to have honor, but we need to expect them to act with honor. And if they don't, then shame on us. Mm-hmm. If we don't hold them to those kinds of standards. The last words of the Declaration of Independence, and I, again, this is one of the things I discovered by looking this kind of granular way at their stories rather than the big sweeping generalizations that historians often use, is the last phrase in the Declaration of Independence is, "We pledge our sacred honor." So the notion that you are defined by your honor or by your lack of honor was very much a part of this kind of founding era. And of course, obviously, especially in the late 20th century and today, that's a harder commodity, which may be why it's more important than ever to stand up for it. Now, you don't have to duel, by the way. Don't go that far, please. This gentleman, I think you had a question. Oh, your question was answered. Okay, fine. Another gentleman has a question, and maybe we can pass the mic, and that way nobody has to get up and trek to the back. Yes.
Wasn't it against the law? Wasn't dueling against the law at that time?
Well, yeah, it was dueling against the law, absolutely. And so what's kind of interesting is Aaron Burr is the sitting vice president of the United States. So it's like as if Pence, you know, goes and plugs somebody and then goes back to Washington, D.C., where you can't hold him accountable. Now, now that's a different problem. But at this time, actually, Burr was wanted for murder and had there were actually warrants out for his murder in New Jersey and in New York. But he escaped to the one place where the law couldn't touch him, which was Washington, D.C. Because at this period of time, there weren't national enforcement mechanisms, you know, federal law, state law. This was a crime in, at the state level, but there wasn't yet a federal mechanism for this. So he could literally and literally go back to Washington and pick up his gavel and bang, you know, rule in the U.S. Senate. In fact, the crazy thing is it was said that he ruled particularly well in the Senate after that. Maybe his nerves had calmed after he killed Alexander Hamilton. So it was illegal, and in fact, after the duel, there was this extraordinary outpouring of grief. You know, we today, we don't know who Alexander Hamilton was, and people are like, well, which president was he? You know, but at the time, he was very, 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 very well known. And in New York, especially, it was kind of interesting that he was a New Yorker, you know, a quintessential immigrant, a place where you could go. Maybe people wouldn't know who you were, and you could make your name all by yourself. And so New York was especially, you know, heartbroken over it, and there was flag, you know, black drapery everywhere and that kind of thing. And so in places like New York, that was a real, you know, there was a real concern about it. And then anti-dueling association starts up. So the movement, the social movement, this sort of sense that maybe this isn't an okay thing to do, is that feeling is sped by the death of Alexander Hamilton. And that helps people to sort of move away from dueling culture, which wasn't just American, by the way. I mean, this was really a Western world phenomenon. The code duello by which they all fought was an Irish. Of course, the Irish are a little pugilistic. It's been known, it's been said before. I'm a little Irish background myself, so I'm, you know, I'm not slamming anybody. My husband is Irish. So in any case, those Irishmen, they're the ones who came up with the code duello. And again, this is one of those things that sometimes people will say, well, maybe Hamilton was just this, you know, crazy guy. But actually, not long after his death, the Prime Minister of Great Britain found himself insulted, or at least he felt insulted, by the Foreign Minister of Great Britain. Now, they're in the same party, and they're in the same government. But the Foreign Minister challenges the Prime Minister to a duel. And you know, I can't remember who was in which position at the same time, because they tended to switch around, but Castlereagh and Canning. Now, Canning had been raised by an actress. He had never been in the military. He did not know how to fire a gun. But he went to, you know, he went to his possible doom, and Castlereagh was a good shot. Castlereagh simply wounded him, but Canning walked with a limp for the rest of his life. So here are people in the most highest positions of eminence that you can think of who felt that they had no choice but to defend their honor.
Do we know what happened to Angelica?
What happened to Angelica Schuyler? Yes, she died. Everybody in my book did. No, it's a good question. Angelica, Eliza lived the longest of those brothers and sisters. Angelica, Peggy dies early, by the way. If you see the musical, you'll see lovely Peggy, who's even worse flirt than Angelica. Angelica, I can't remember exactly when she dies, but it's, you know, a more normal age. Eliza, as I said, lives to 97. But Angelica is happily married, and by the way, despite the play, when she meets Alexander Hamilton, it's actually Eliza who meets him first, and Angelica is happily married and expecting her second child. So sorry to disappoint, but they had a good marriage. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any personal thoughts or opinions about Hamilton's relationship with John Laurens based off of their letters?
Ooh, ah, I see. I sense a person who's read a little more deeply on this subject. John Laurens. John Laurens was an amazing man. He Lawrence and the Marquis de Lafayette and Hamilton were like, you know, the Three Musketeers or something. I mean, they were close friends, and they lived, you know, they were aides-de-camp to George Washington, although Lawrence and Lafayette were from the pillars of society, I mean, the very peaks of their respective social circles. So it was this interesting pairing, because here's Hamilton, just, you know, ragamuffin orphan, really, and he becomes these great friends. Some people have said that Lawrence was such an intimate of Alexander Hamilton, and they were so close. The letters they wrote, and again, this is the era. People write letters a little differently from how we would today. And some people said, well, maybe there was a homoerotic relationship even. Maybe he and Lawrence, you know, they went farther than simply being best friends. Now, again, by the way, Lawrence was married, just FYI, and Lawrence, in fact, had gotten his wife pregnant. That's why he became married to her. So he was, you know, an active young man, one might say. And it was Lawrence to whom Alexander wrote, saying, hey, you know, maybe I should be looking around. And it was Lawrence who encouraged him to marry, to find a wife, but partly because Hamilton was this social outsider. I mean, as long as the revolution was going on and he was traveling in those circles, it was one thing, but, you know, that would come to an end. And then where would he be? So I think they were very close. And again, part of the other remarkable thing I'll say about that trio is that they were the abolitionists in the government, in that new government. I love Lawrence. I mean, Lawrence is this fella. If you go back, if you ever Google, like, you know, slave auction notices, I don't know why you would, but let's say you did. One of the typical ones that will come up is, it's one of the oldest, and it says, you know, for sale, blah-de, blah-de, blah. And at the bottom, it has the symbol of the house, of the company that's selling them, and it's Lawrence and Sons. So John's Lawrence father, who was actually a member of the Continental Congress, president of the Continental Congress, was the biggest slave trader, you know, in North America at the time. And John Lawrence, who had everything to lose, said, this is wrong. So he was one of the people who was trying to come up with plans to help slaves get free. And that was something that Hamilton loved about Lawrence. I mean, and Lafayette, too. They all shared in that deep sentiment. And so I think it's part of the reason for their intimacy. But so sadly, John Lawrence dies just before the revolution is over. He's one of the last casualties. He dies in South Carolina on the Cumbie River, where, by the way, Harriet Tubman, the subject of my next book, she also she has a story to tell about that particular place, the same place that she led a raid where John Lawrence died. That's one of those great little kismet things in American history. Yes, ma'am.
Can you outline or give your thoughts on whether or not Hamilton was actually going to shoot and kill Aaron Burr, or whether or not he was going just to protect his own honor?
Yeah, now this is an interesting question, because again, Ron Chernow, and any good historian, and he's a great historian, says, well, you know, he might have done it for this reason, and then he might have done it for that reason. And we have this evidence, and we have that evidence. But in a novel, you are that person. You know, you have your reason. You know what you're going to do, or at least, you know, you have your plan. And I believe, based on the evidence we do have, and there is pretty substantial evidence, that Hamilton truly did not want to duel Burr. He did not practice shooting. Burr did target practicing in the 2 weeks prior to the duel. The duel had been scheduled for a while. I guess it's sort of like going to the dentist or something. If the duel was scheduled, Hamilton did not practice, in fact, refused to practice with the guns. He wrote, he told his second, the man who came with him, that he did not plan. He planned to fire if they had a second round, because it was often the case in duels that you would have a first round, everybody shoot wild, you know, nobody get hurt. And then you could say, I demand the right to a second try. And then you would have a second round. And Hamilton, so he said, and so he told people, communicated at the time, planned to shoot the second time. Now, the plot thickens. The mystery deepens, as it always does, because Hamilton's gun was actually discharged. So do we think that, and so two guns were fired, Hamilton fell, Burr was unwounded, untouched. So what happened there? And there were no eyewitnesses to the actual moment, because it was a crime, and they didn't want those people to be accessories to murder in some way, so nobody was watching. So later in life, Burr said that he saw this branch fall, that, and on my novel, you know, Hamilton is aiming for that, knows that he has to shoot, he has to fire, and he fires in the air and he hits something else. So I don't think there's any reason to think that he was, you know, gunning for Burr. He did not issue the challenge. It was Burr who did. He tried to fend it off, but, you know, Ron Chernow says, well, he didn't try very hard. Yeah, well, mm-hmm. I think that he also felt like, if you're asking me to apologize for everything I've said about you, I can't. That would be telling a lie. And so I think he was willing to pay the price for truth.
Speaking of honesty, he worked for George Washington for a long time. What about their relationship? How did George Washington pick him out to be an aide-de-camp? Was he a lower-level person in the military, and then he saw his talent, or how did that happen? Do you know?
Well, yeah. Well, so the interesting thing about Hamilton, so he's just this scholarship student at King's College, right? How is he going to get into this kind of thing? And what he does, what all good students do, I tell my students about this, you go to the library and you get a book. And so he went to the library and literally got a book about artillery because he was interested in being an artillery officer. And then he did know some prominent people and he talked his way in and he got appointed to lead an artillery company. And New York's first whatever, and I can't remember now the exact name of the regiment. But so he was an artillery man. But he was just this kid, really. And sort of figuring it out. How do you shoot? What's the aim of trajectory, et cetera, et cetera. And so he was there in the first battles when New York was occupied by the British and George Washington's army was really defeated and fleeing. And Hamilton actually covered the rear guard. So Hamilton was on several occasions covering the retreating Continentals who were just being beaten badly again and again. And in that course of that, Washington consulted him on one occasion and said, you know, how will you position the guns? And we don't exactly know the moment exactly how it unfolded, but they came to know each other. And after this sort of famous battle, which, of course, I cover in the book, the crossing the Delaware moment, which is this really cool moment. I mean, it's this very suspenseful, I think, moment. And so it's after that, and then Hamilton distinguishes himself in a couple of other ways, the battle at Princeton, et cetera. By the way, he was a short man, and he was so young. That somebody later wrote that they saw this young man, you know, with his cannons, and the boy was patting the cannon, you know, and they thought, oh, is that a kid who's leading that? And then they realized that, no, it was this young man, this Alexander Hamilton, this person that people whose name was being tossed around by that point. And so it was that then in January, after the battle of, you know, against the Hessians at a crossing the Delaware moment at Washington's Crossing, that he was asked by Washington to come in. And now he was known as a writer by that point because he'd written some Revolutionary era pamphlets, and he was just smart as a whip.
Good. We have time for one more question if anyone would like to ask the last question. Great.
Oh, this lady had...
Oh, okay.
Would you mind, since, gentlemen, you got a chance? And
wonder how he got motivated to come from Nevis to America. I mean, what this kid that doesn't have any family, and how did he do that?
Yeah, he was, I can't remember, I think he might have been about 16 at that point. So how did he come from Nevis and, pardon me, from St. Croix? He, you know, he was orphaned. He got an apprenticeship. He became a clerk in a company that people sort of started to realize that he was just this bright young man. He wrote a very famous letter. He wrote some stuff he got in the local newspaper. And he wrote this letter about this huge hurricane that hit the island. And it's just this passionate description, you know, of what happened. And they began to take up a little collection. Let's send this boy to the mainland, you know. He really ought to go to school, I think. So they put together a little college scholarship fund. And, you know, he had nothing to stay for. And so he went, of course, like any good immigrant, to New York. And he went to grammar school. And because he hadn't been to school. Now, why he had not been to school was because he was a bastard. And he couldn't go to the church school like other kids could. And so he got his first formal education in the United States. Well, it wasn't yet the United States, but in New Jersey and New York. And this gentleman had one other question. Yes.
Yeah. I understood that one of the effects of Hamilton's writing about his affair in detail was that then kind of canceled out his opportunity to run for president, which he planned to do.
Yes, how did that affect his political opportunities? Well, it's kind of an odd thing. Yes, it definitely damaged him, the affair and his admitting to it. And as I said, his friends had said, don't admit to it. You know, they say all kinds of crazy stuff all the time. It'll just float away. But he felt he couldn't. You know, he felt he had to correct this record. And it probably damaged him very deeply. He could not become president. But I don't think he would have run for president, because before the affair was out, he always knew they had that on him. By the way, you might ask how they got the letters that he had written to Mariah Reynolds, because that's how it all happened. And that's one of the reasons why this pamphlet became so long, because he published the letters that had been back and forth, blackmail letters, etc., to prove that this thing occurred as he had said it did. And the reason why the letters got out initially, he then later published them, was because the Congress had done an investigation. They were always investigating Hamilton, always finding him clean, but then always finding another reason to investigate him again. So James Monroe had gotten the letters, and James Monroe said he would keep them in a safe place once Hamilton said, well, this is not about corruption, it's about this affair, and I'm embarrassed, but, you know, please don't tell anybody, because, you know, gentlemen of honor wouldn't reveal these things about each other. But somehow, the safe place that the letters had been kept turned out not to be very safe. Some people think they might have been like held perhaps at Monticello, which was the next door neighbor of James Monroe. It's possible. So we don't exactly know how that happened. But so his career was compromised from the moment that woman walked into his life.
Great.
Oh. And if you wish to buy books, we have them in the back. And I know this gentleman was going to say something about that. How about if I come back and answer it?
Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Professor. And we didn't hear about that Jefferson Hamilton thing.
Ooh.
Next time. That's okay, great. Thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion.